It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
I'm afraid of them taking my money! Taking my money! Taking my money! Bad, 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 evil! Evil! I don't want them to take my money. Well, they're taking my money, and we need to understand how they're doing it. Because now, they want to take my house. After they took my money. So this is what we're, off air, we're trying to get, you know, I want to make sure I understand definitions of words and everything. This is as a summary as I understand it. We're in studio with Cynthia Cantrell. She's a real estate investor and an agent and now a real estate expert witness in a lot of these cases going to the judge saying, look, man, I'm showing you evidence of fraud on the court. Aren't you supposed to do something about that? It wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. So this is all of a sudden this is going on across the country for a year or two. And then all of a sudden it starts getting so overwhelmingly obvious that some judges are like, yeah, I think we're going to have to. I mean, when we got multiple pieces of paperwork that got created in some foreclosure mill and they're overlapping and it's obvious somebody just made this up. And I recognize I got to do something. And it got to the point that it's bad enough that in 23 states that have a different method of foreclosing on homes, which has to be a court action. In Arizona, you just file paperwork and say, and here, gimme. Well, you have to be more proactive. You got to go sue. Well, in these other states, you know, the suit is against you, so you can defend. Well, you kind of like get to defend. I'd like to defend. May I defend? Thank you for letting me defend. So they go through this process, and it becomes obvious that they're just making up stuff. So they go, whoa, GMAC, JP Morgan, Bank of America. We're stopping all foreclosures until we can figure out how to screw them another way. Okay, much as here it comes. So here we have Congress. Oh, we're going to step in. We gotta retroactively make what all this legal stuff that they did like legal or something. You know, get ready for that. Now we were talking about. I want to clear this up. As I understood it, you have the deed of trust, which is the home and the description and so on. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You have the note, which is the obligation of somebody to pay money, or they say that you owe us and you sign here, give me money. Now, I thought what bound the two of those was a document called an allonge. And you're saying, no, the allonge goes with the note.
Correct.
Right? Now, define that word. What is that document? What does it do?
The allonge is it's a piece of paper that basically is behind the note. It has to be permanently affixed by staples to the note. When the note has too many what we call assignment stamps on it for any more to fit on the last page where you sign the note, then they have to add an additional page to it. That's called an allonge. The allonge is there to show the ownership as that note is sold from entity to entity to entity. They stamp the note from your first lender, pay to the order of without recourse. In my case, it's Homecomings Financial was endorsing it. And they left the line to who in blank. And then the next entity would come in. They'd own it. They'd sign it. Then when they sold the note to, in my case, it was to this trust, there needs to be another stamp on there that goes from Countrywide to the trust. And then eventually Bank of America's foreclosing. So there would have to be another stamp on there from Bank of America.
Okay, let's stop right there and understand something. This is like having an open title on your car. You sign and notarize your signature, you know, that you're going to do this thing, but you don't assign it to anybody. You just leave it blank. And I got a clear open title here, come whatever. And you could have bought it from a guy that bought it from a guy that bought it from a guy. And, you know, which has happened. I mean, here in Arizona, they do that all the time. So when you go and you want to sell your car, You know, you go and you get it notarized that you're signing it over, but you don't fill in who. The reason you can do that, makes it convenient, is that, and you don't want to be having that laying around, somebody pick it up, now it's their car. But, you know, that is the ownership of the car, is that title. When you sign that and notarize it and so on, you're now walking around with cash. I mean, you're walking around with a car. You're walking around with ownership of that car. So you go to Craigslist and you say, come get my car. Well, my daughter just sold one of her vehicles. Well, the guy comes over on a Saturday or Sunday, and he's all angry. It takes him 2-3 hours to go find a notary out of the Yellow Pages, wipe, you know, internet and local 24/7 kind of pay me $20 to sign my name notary so that they can have her sign it over to him so he can take it and be done with it. They like to have it signed first so it's easily transferable. So my question is, when they do this on these notes, I'll bet you every time they sell this, they don't always go changing the name and get it notarized and reproducing more paperwork. They just got an open title they're negotiating around on the internet or something.
You're exactly right. They call that endorsing in blank or bearer note. And that is what my particular note has, just one stamp. I believe I should have 3 or 4 stamps on mine, but I have one. They just left it blank. It didn't say who it was paid to the order of. But basically, they take my note and they turn it into a check. This has value. This is a form of currency. This note is of mine is worth $448,000. So the next entity that owns this, now they have a piece of paper worth $448,000.
Now, if you add into the reason they just wanted to create the note, and because when it goes to the next person, I guarantee you they're not doing it at a loss. They're going to the next person because it has value, because it has interest. All right?
Correct.
So it's not really worth $400,000. It's worth, you know, $1.6 million or some crap like that over the time.
Absolutely.
So they go, okay, well, how much is it? It's just like trading treasury notes and so on. So they go, all right, so we turn this note into a bearer bond, you know, a document, an open title or whatever, that now we're going to go trade it. The problem is whenever you did that in the past, the way you do it, like what you're talking about, you had to go ahead and transfer this, fill out the paperwork, file it with the county recorder. Everybody knows who has a standing to foreclose or something, yada, yada. But that took time. I don't want to have to do that. I want to trade this thing 15 gazillion times, you know, a day. I mean, I make it a line on an Excel spreadsheet. I want to be able to trade this online. And they would take a bunch of these and they would pool them into a bunch of mortgages. So they have these big, giant pools of mortgages, and then they would go ahead and they would rate them. Now, this is where they got Moody's. They threw in a couple of good guys in there with 750 credit scores, and they go, yeah, check the, oh, yeah, these guys are good, and 80% of them are, you know, no doc loans or something, and they got Moody's to give them a AAA rating somehow. That's where the problem was, if not the fraud. So, you know, the beginning, you know, part of it. So what they do is they got all these in a pool, and then they get some pension fund somewhere to go ahead and give them a Goldman Sachs of $1 billion, of which they put half or more in their pocket. And then they take and they take the rest of it and invest it in these pools of mortgages. Okay? That's where we're at. But they're all sitting there, not really assigned to anybody. So when it comes time to foreclose, who gets to foreclose? Who's filled out on the paperwork? Who has the line of title? Who has the obligation? Who has the benefit of getting the money? Who? I don't know. Well, they didn't either. So what'd they do? They made them up. Well, that's what Cynthia Cantrell is going to tell us about firsthand. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. besides me, Ernest Hancock, we have Tom Westbrook has come by and going to help us out with a little the way it was back in the day and what he's doing now, because he and his family have been dealing real estate for a long, long, long time, since the 50s, back when it used to be semi-legal. And then organized crime came in the 60s, and that kind of changed. But, you know, what we'll go ahead and do is we're going to finish up with Cynthia, and we'll get Tom, you know, here when we need him, certainly in the last hour. But I want him here for this part of it so that he can use his personal experience to shed some more light on what's going on. We have in studio Cynthia Cantrell. And she's been in real estate for a long time, and she's gotten learned up on it. You know, enough, studied it, that she can actually go into court and with confidence going, oh, Mr. Judging Man, you know, Mr. Black Robe, let me show you what's up. You know, this is what's going on. So she's been, and what do you call you, a title abstractor?
Yes.
What the heck does that mean anyway?
Basically, I am able to follow the chain of title, the historical chain from the very beginning of the property all the way forward. One of my specialties, though, is these foreclosure documents that the banks are using to foreclose on people, which is from the deed of trust that you sign at title all the way forward, all of the assignments of deed of trust, any substitution of trustees, and, of course, the notice of trustee sale.
Okay, so that's where we left off, is that what is of value is not the home. That's like you need, like, I don't know, bulldozers and stuff. I mean, you know, you need to, like, pick it up and move it and spaceships and something. So it's just there. It's being a pain in the butt. That's not what's a value to these guys in the stock market. It's the note behind it. They're going, okay, so we got a note that we can put in big giant piles and go ahead and trade it on the internet, and it always goes up and up and up. And if you did the research on this, these loans, if you did the maximum 30 years, paid it all off at one end, and that's one thing that you learn in real estate school, you start going on about, it has to be FHA compliant. It has to be, you know, it has to be a set format that they want. And the reason was, this became a big deal right before the bubble burst here in Arizona. They were pushing the Arizona Realty Association or National Realty Association, because they were selling and buying a lot of homes in Mexico, Rocky Point, and so on. They wanted to try, because there, a notary is like a hereditary title. There, you pass it down to your sons. You got, oh, you need to have that document notarized so you can build your resort on the whatever? I think that'll be like $2 million for me to say, you need my signature, right? Well, guess what? How much are you willing to pay? And you think I'm kidding? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes on. So what they were trying to do is they wanted to get the same kind of harmonized system of real estate that we have here in the U.S., certainly in Arizona, in Mexico. They wanted to make it to where it was all uniform forms and documents so that they could do the same exact thing in Mexico that they were doing here. I went to these seminars. I went and talked. I mean, I'm sitting, I'm going, I see what you guys are trying to do. So what they did is they go, all right, here they have a set format so that they could easily take and put them. Who do you think drives the country? You know, the banks. And they said, we need to have this all formatted in such a way that we can take these notes and we put them in groups. We have open title on them. You know, we have open, we assign them to whoever's the last guy to fill in the blank. Okay. And then we start negotiating them. Because if you look at all of these homes, let's say they're average $300,000 or something, $300,000 homes back when it was at the peak, and you have all these gazillion homes, well, if you paid them to their full thing, it could be, you know, a group that's a billion could easily be, I don't know, a trillion. I mean, you know, a lot. So they would have, even to the point that some of these, I would imagine, they got ramped up to even more than what they were worth at the maximum if everybody made all their payments till the end. So this is just, it was just an excuse to be able to make money and transfer it from where the buckets of money was in the pension funds and so on, and put it in the bank's pocket. That's what this was all about. But it's coming unwound. Because it only worked as long as people were making their payments, as long as the return on these mortgage-backed securities were, you know, in the black. They're like, okay, it's all good. I don't care. You foreclose on a couple. It's just not a big deal. What happens is all of a sudden everybody starts, you know, they had this bubble big. They had Shoeshine Boys, you know, buying his McMansion. So now we have a situation to where they're starting to foreclose on a lot of people that, you know, maybe know how to read and stuff. So that's where Cynthia comes in. Now, Cynthia, as they have that, they start to do a foreclosure proceeding on you or whoever you're representing or so on. They come in and they say, you know, we're going to take your home. You go, not a problem. Now, you show me you're the guy on the note that has the ability to foreclose, right?
That is called show me the note theory, and that has been shot down over and over and over in courts, and here's why. When they receive your promissory note, you basically give that to them. They own it. They have no obligation to show it to you again. They bought it. It's like me selling you my car. If I sell you my car, you paint it green, and I say, hey, I heard you painted my car green. I want to see it. Bring it to me so I can see it. You don't have an obligation to me because you bought it. They bought this note from me. This note has value. And what the banks do, and this is one of their dirty little secrets they don't want anyone to know, is they take this note and they use this as collateral to get their own loan with. Now, I've heard as many as 27 times the value of this document is what the bank gets a loan from.
Yeah, it's called toxic waste. Fannie and Obama's your landlord. That's what's that going on. What do you think the bailout was about? So they have this note. It's of value to them, and they mm-hmm. got, you know, it's toxic and whatever. Mm-hmm. And Uncle Sam says, you know, that's not a problem. Here's some money. But, you know, I still want to see how it is that they have some kind of you have some kind of resistance to them taking your home.
Absolutely. That's where the deed of trust comes in. Now, we talked a lot about allonges that go with the note. Every time the note travels, it has to have a stamp from entity to entity to entity.
That's just posted.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, the deed of trust has its own documentation that goes with it. In this state, it's called an assignment of deed of trust. So that means, in my case, it would have had to go from Homecomings to Countrywide to the trust, then the trust to Bank of America, in order to have Bank of America have the right to be able to try to foreclose on the deed of trust.
Now, do these two documents, the deed of trust and the note, do they have to have the same documentation?
Yes, ultimately they do. The note would have an allonge stamped from Homecomings to Countrywide first. The deed of trust would have an assignment of deed of trust from Homecomings.
Okay, now
to
what
Countrywide.
If they didn't match?
Right then, if they didn't match, then what happens is the deed of trust is invalid because it has to always travel with the note. So if the note's going in one direction and the deed of trust doesn't go with it, pursuant to Carpenter v. Longan, the deed of trust is invalid and they can't take your property.
Okay, so I can see where we're going. All right. So now we have here in Arizona, they took your note and they're out, you know, playing, make money with it. All right. Then they like having this open title thing because, you know, less paperwork. All right. So then they go in and they say, you know, hey, whoever is with this is not making payments anymore. Well, that kind of sucks. And since, and the way I understood it is these mortgage-backed securities and so on didn't really have any kind of ownership or anything of the home. They just had rights to the revenue stream of the payments. I mean, how far off am I on that?
Well, you're not far off at all, because ultimately what we talked about in the very beginning was this deed of trust did not follow the note in the very beginning. It went to the county recorder's office. The note went to the lender. So from the very beginning, they were not together. They were not documents that was, you know, connected together as needed to be to where they could travel together. So as soon as there's a break, and the break in the chain of document title can be as simple as sending the deed of trust to the county recorder's office.
Okay. Now, they have a note that, you know, says you, I don't know, does it even have your name on it? I mean, is it, you know, it says you, right?
That's an interesting question. No, it actually doesn't. It the note is all about borrower. And borrowers...
Well, it doesn't have your name on it anywhere?
No, not until you sign at the very end. It does not list who borrower is anywhere on the note, if you can believe that.
All right. When we come back, we'll understand this even more, because my question is that if they have all this money, do you still owe the money, but they don't have the ability to foreclose on you? And you go, yeah, I owe you that money. Try and get it from me. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to stay in my house. I mean, you know, is that where we're at? I mean, I don't know. A good question, though, and you're going to have to wait to find the answer when we come back here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied. I don't need you. I've got to break free.
Oh, God knows. And as many people as I can tell, I just got to break free. And I tell you how we do that here on Freedom's Phoenix and Declare Your Independence. You know, what's our slogan on Freedom's Phoenix? Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That, you know, that's the one thing I found through all my political activism and so on. Just seeking the truth. That just, man, ain't no heck no. We don't want the truth out there, and we'll hide it and obfuscate it and spin it and do whatever we can to get whatever it is that we want. But in order to get the program going, in order to start people to investing into the system and believe it, they got to get you into the mindset that they are there to help. They're there to protect your property rights. They're there to do it the right way. They're the judges to make sure when it's done wrong, they're going to fix it. They're going to hold people responsible for lying, cheating, stealing. They're the bad guys. You know, but is that how it works? Not in my experience. Not ever in my experience. I've been doing all kinds of, you know, looking at what's going on for a long time. And I'll tell you, it's like every time it's always who you know. Well, let me tell you who you need to know. A banker. You know, the little top hat guy on the Monopoly game. I mean, you know, you got, I got to tell you this. I saw this on TV. They got a new Monopoly game now. They don't use money. It's electronically transferred money little thing, getting everybody all worked up. No, you don't need any of that funny Monopoly money. You need to start getting indoctrinated using funny electrons. I went, oh, man, it's killing me. All right, so we have the creation of the note. We have the description of the property. And I need to know, is there an obligation to pay this note, once they take it and they go off and they're trading amongst banks and they're, you know, flipping it back and forth amongst each other and doing whatever they're doing, I mean, does that still have some kind of legal validity to you owe the money?
Well, it depends on whether or not you can read the verbiage that's in the note and believe that you are a borrower. Because ultimately, it is borrower's promise to pay for this amount of money. In this case, in my case, it's $448,000. It never defines who borrower is, which I find very odd, because if I were lending somebody $448,000, I would want to absolutely explain who borrower is.
Well, I know who borrower is when the judge brings a gavel down and says, you it. I mean, seriously. I mean, that's what it's going to wind up being. You know, whether you would think that they'd want to say, you are the borrower, sure. You know. And on the last page, I notice it says, you know, I witness this, and it says borrow underneath, but it's not in caps. I mean, come on, I'm a judge, and I'm siding with the bank. Guess what's going to happen?
Well, and the other interesting thing is it also says witness the hands and the seals of the undersigned. And when you take a look back in time, every note in deed of trust had to have a family seal on it in order for it to be valid. And that is still here. That seal is there. So when I write an affidavit about documentation, I put in there that, you know, it's there. It's supposed to have a seal, and I'm not finding one there. Therefore, pursuant to all the reasons that I give, I find this document to be invalid. Now, that is my opinion. Everybody has one. I read it. It's taken me a long time to decipher both the deed of trust and the note, and I'm just reading their verbiage. And
okay, so let me ask and get the answer to my question. Assume that this doesn't have anything to do with the deed. It doesn't have anything to do with whether they can foreclose or not. It doesn't have any. Does it still obligate that person to make a payment to them?
If you go by what the adjustable rate note says, in my opinion, no, it does not. But there's going to be a lot of people arguing that it does. Now, we discussed off air about whether or not if ownership of the note, whether just ownership of a note is enough to foreclose on the property, and we talked about that it is not.
Okay, well, I haven't got to that part yet.
Okay.
I'm still saying that, you know, they got these, we got this person right here, we got a judge that says she owes money, which means if they did that, even if they couldn't foreclose, they could put a lien on the property, so if you ever did sell or something, that they get, you know, first they're in line right after the IRS or something, okay? So I'm going, all right, so let's go ahead and operate on that. What you're saying is that even though you may, which you're not conceding, but let's say, you know, one, they got you on this piece of paper saying you owe $400,000, and they go, okay, well, I can't foreclose on your house, but gosh darn it, you're my slave now. I mean, you know, you owe me or something, right?
That's what they say. Now, what is interesting, the group that I'm with, showmetheloan.net is our group, and we are asking them to show us where in the documents it says that we actually received a loan from, in my case, it would be Homecoming's Financial Network, Inc. Nowhere in the deed of trust and nowhere in this adjustable rate note can I find any evidence that I was ever lent the sum of $448,000 by Homecoming's. There is no verbiage that says that. In fact, what it says is very tricky, very complicated, and it took me a long time to really understand what it was saying. Borrowers promised to pay. In return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay $448,000. And that would make you think that you received a loan, because it's saying in return for a loan that I have received. However, that's past tense. That is not descriptive of a loan being of the sum of $448,000 from Homecoming's. It's very difficult for most people to understand this verbiage, and that's why I spell it out very detailed in my affidavits, because ultimately, in my opinion, in return for a loan I have received would be the same thing as myself saying to you, Ernie, in return for that shirt you already own, you owe me $50. Does that make sense? Why would I get to charge you $50 for something you already own?
Well, I can tell you how they're going to argue it. You know, that I received, then it's like they're saying that you got the house, it got transferred by signing, you know, this, or we created, or we approved, or we signed our side of it. You know, it's already, you know, it's a done deal. And as soon as you sign that, well, you know, somebody's satisfied that they got theirs because you get to move in the house.
Sure, and I understand that. But when they come to me and say that I am defaulting on a loan, show me the loan. Show me where I got the loan. I don't recall receiving $448,000 in my checking account. I never received a check that I had to endorse and send to the seller or the home builder, in my case. I never saw that money. I never had a pile of money that I moved over to the seller.
See, I can understand that this is what judges are for, okay? Mm-hmm. This is why we're supposed to have judges. They'll come in and they'll go, all right, we got to settle this dispute. We have, you know, was there or was there not a transfer? And that's a whole other argument. Was there money transferred to somebody from something? It has to be something in consideration of. Well, they didn't really, just kind of, you know, pushed little, you know, keys on a computer. But you go, all right, well, a judge is going, you know what? In my infinite wisdom, and because I got a black robe and the power and a gavel, I say that, yeah, you're the one. You signed it. You owe it. They got it. Done. All right. Now, let's go ahead and, you know, we can go back and forth on this, but it's either you are obligated to pay back this money for that or you're not. Okay. Well, that's going to be a judge going to say whatever based on whatever. My question is that obligation has to be tied to collateral, a home, a something. And then is it? Do they? My problem is, as I looked through it, I couldn't understand. All these arguments here, I have the same, you know, reaction. I'm going, yeah, well, a judge is going to say whatever the heck they want, okay? And they got even a tenuous little thread of kind of justification for them saying it. They're going to do it. But then they ran into something. In the process of this, when they made the transfer and started, you know, leaving this open title that's getting lumped into a whole bunch of other mortgages, and they're doing this mortgage-backed security thing, they couldn't show that they actually owned the home. They couldn't have it linked to your deed, okay? They didn't want that because then it made them susceptible to taxes. That's why they went offshore. That's why they did the real estate mortgage investment conduit, you know, conduit. I love that conduit thing. That's my favorite part. So they had this conduit. But if they showed any kind of ownership of the home or had them linked, well, then they'd have to pay up to 100% in taxes. I mean, it was like, man, you go, ooh, you get nailed. Well, there was no way that they could, you know, do this and them make money. Certainly not take a bunch of the principal up front, as Goldman Sachs goes, yeah, give me your 60%. We'll go ahead and invest the 40% in these mortgage-backed securities, these lumps of your mortgages out there. And as long as the revenue stream is going, you're all good. But without showing any ownership, there's no taxes on it, so everybody's good as long as people start, you know, keep paying their mortgages. When they stop, well, then they got documents that they need in order to foreclose to try and get something back on this $400,000-something. That's where the problem is. Because they severed there's a separation there somewhere, somehow, that they're not linked up right. That's where they get Fannie going to all of these law firms saying, better start making some paperwork. In fact, they have this one company called DocX or something. Is that, you've heard of them?
Yes.
Well, what's DocX? What is it that they do?
Basically, from what I understand, is they're just another document mill. There's all over the country are document mills, and they just have employees sitting there creating documents. They'll get a order in. We need an assignment. We need a substitution of trustee to this company. We need an affidavit that we had the right to do this, and we need it signed by a vice president. And they'll just go ahead and say, okay, I'm the vice president of ABC Mortgage today, and I am assigning you to CBS Mortgage this document.
You know, and that's where they got caught, you know, because they were making a bunch of mistakes on doing that. We'll talk about it more, and we'll start getting into that part of it when we come back on Declare Your Independence with Cynthia Cantrell in just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, in the studio. We have Cynthia Cantrell and Tom Westbrook, my good friends, in. He'll have some input on this in the next hour, too. But I want to make sure he was in, sitting on this. We can see where we're going with this. I want to make this one point. You can argue that they didn't do, yes, they did, no, they didn't, and things change, and eventually that's where you got black robes and a judge and a gavel and go, yeah, well, I ruled this way, okay? The argument is that, okay, didn't you get a loan from so-and-so? Well, Your Honor, if I say that, I'd be like perjuring myself because, no, I didn't. I got a promissory note for a promissory note of a check that went to them to promise them whatever, and I get to live in a house. You know, so you can argue how many, you know, lawyers can dance on the head of a pen, but, you know, the bottom line is there's a judge, if he's got even a little bit of wiggle room to rule in favor of the man, that's what he's going to do. My point is this. When I go through all kinds of different management training, when I was in the restaurant industry and know my own restaurant, you go to seminars, you go down, and I'll tell you this one little story and make my point. Whenever you need to terminate an employee, okay, you would go through, I think I maybe fired in 15 years of restaurant, or more than that, I probably fired maybe 3 people. I mean, it's for blatant whatever. Because I understood the management style is that you document, you do follow-up. You go, all right, now this is the behavior that we're looking forward to. You understand, yes, do follow-up right here. Yeah, got it. It's all good. Next meeting, now you're doing it. You know, we got improvement. Yeah, it's all good. Cool. You're not? Oh, well, you know, next time we have a follow-up, you know, we need to talk. You know, and as you go through time, they pretty much terminate themselves. They realize, okay, you know, I was dragging out as long as I could. They just leave, quit. You make a mutual agreement, you're gone. Or they didn't fulfill whatever, and, you know, problem solved. The problem is that sometimes when you fire someone for a reason, I always knew you find one good reason. Because if you got, a lot of people will make the mistake, and I see this in the mortgage thing, they come in and they pick out every single thing that they can come up with. This and this and this and this and this and this, and you got one kick butt, the guy went over and kicked the customer in the shin, and you go and you start talking about, well, he was late all these times, and he didn't cut his hair, and he didn't do this, he didn't. So what do they do at your wage and hourly board meetings? They come in, they have a little adjudication, and they'll say, well, you know, this other employee's got long hair and you didn't fire them. Well, this other employee came in late on, you didn't fire them. And they'll go through, pick apart every single one of your dozen reasons that you have for getting rid of this guy, and they lose the one good reason that you had. You diminish your argument with all this other stuff. Should it come up? Maybe. You know, you know, I don't know how much you dwell on it. I don't know how important it is. Maybe you have another case that focuses on that one point so you can get a ruling on that one point. But if you have every single case brings up 15 gazillion things, you miss the importance of the one thing. Do they have the right to foreclose? Are they the person on the piece of paper that has the ability, or was that gone? Yes or no? And that's what's been happening around the country. All this other stuff don't mean jack diddly squat. What has come out is that you have to have the ability to foreclose on this property. Do you? Only if you have the right documentation. Well, they didn't. So what do? They go to these law firms that are hired by your landlord, Obama, at Fannie Mae, and they say, you know, we need to foreclose on a bunch of these, and we need to do it quick. I mean, we are getting rock and rolling on this. I was amazed they were going as slow as they were, to be honest. Because I think they were, that's the reason they were waiting to get all this stuff in line, because they had such a mess. It's taken a month or a year or more just to get it in line so they could do it. You know, just even pretend to do it. Well, now they're doing it. Well, they stopped them. Well, now where all those people go? They're going to go in the states like Arizona and go, ooh, we're going to get busy here while we're messing around with that over there, get Pelosi change the law. All right? So I'm going, all right. Here they have these mills that are creating all of these documents. They're filing them with the court. They're filing them with the county recorders. They're filing, oh, we need whatever. They go through the file. They know what they need. And they go to these, you know, DocX or these different mill farms, and they got a price list. We printed it up on Freedom's Phoenix. Here's your price list. Need this, need this, need this, need this. Affidavit of the lost title. Yeah, we lost it. It was right here next to my hard. I can't find it. Okay? So we're recreating it. Then they go in the court and lawyers get up and they get their $400, $800 lawyer guy going, yep, your honor, yep, you know, I'll see you at the golf game and at the club and whatever and sign here. Well, all of a sudden it starts getting so overwhelming, the fraud, that they can see that they were making this stuff up, that they'd have duplicate pieces of documentation, that they have, you know, four things in the file that repeat each other and a little different. I mean, it gets so obvious, they're going, this is not flushing, especially if you get not only people but some attorneys that are really starting to hammer on this, and then it starts to become a fraud problem, not on the court, by the court. So they're going, man, we gotta take a woe on this. So that's where I want to spend my time now. These people can only foreclose on your property if what, Cynthia?
If they have a valid chain of title in which to do so, and they do not. I have not seen a case yet where the entity foreclosing, whether it be Bank of America, Chase, Countrywide, any of those companies, has a valid right to foreclose. Now, that is because they got greedy. The banks got greedy and they pooled all these mortgages into these securitization pool trusts. In my case, they put my note into a trust that was dissolved 6 months before I even took out my purported loan. The trust had already collapsed 6 months before. That's where my note is. I had to hire an expert to find the actual trust my note is in. That means there's not an entity out there today that has a lawful right to foreclose on me. Because they put my note into a defunct trust. Not my fault. I didn't do it.
Why?
Well, they, you know, I have no idea.
Because it was on the list?
I don't know. Countrywide deposited or sold my note to Alternative Loan Trust J13 2005 sometime before Bank of America bought them. And Bank of America has no lawful right to be foreclosing on me. They're just the servicer by right, because Countrywide was the servicer for the trust. At the time that Countrywide used to, you know, have its own company before Bank of America bought them, they only had rights as a servicer. A servicer doesn't hold the note. A servicer is just collecting payments for the trust. That's their role. And we found in the law, in our research group, Title 12, Section 226, .39A1, a servicer of a mortgage shall not be treated as the owner of the obligation. Because they don't have the note. In order to foreclose, we went into this, they have to have the note and the deed of trust. So if the servicer is not going to be treated as the owner of the obligation, which is the note, therefore they can't do anything with the deed of trust. They don't have either document. They're just a debt collector. They're just the mafia guy.
So who
going
are
after
they
people.
Saying is? They're not.
They're not. In my particular situation, Bank of America has a couple other entities. One is called BAC Home Loan Servicing. And somehow they have an assignment to themselves. And they have claimed the beneficial rights to my deed of trust. Well, that's funny. Because the chain was broken as soon as Homecomings did not do an assignment of my deed of trust to Countrywide to begin with. So there's no chain to Countrywide to have then sold it to the trust, and then the trust to have somehow given it to Bank of America. So the chain's broken way long time
well,
ago.
Well, these documents what they're reconstituting, they're generating, uh-huh. They're creating?
Oh, yeah. In my situation.
Or are you giving them a roadmap to screw you? I mean, you know what?
Get this. In my particular situation, they have three documents they're using to foreclose on me. Now, these documents all were notarized by the same notary in Texas on the same day, in the same town of Texas, and they're from three different companies spread out across the United States. One of those companies does business in Michigan. That's where their location is. The other company is in California. Now, these documents were all done in Texas, where the third company is located. They used that company's employed notary to notarize all three documents from on the same day. I mean, the statistics are crazy that somehow what those employees from those two other companies from Michigan and California all decided to convene on Texas and sign before that notary for some reason. Does that make sense?
So you got notary fraud.
We have notary fraud, yes. And in my case, I took it further. I had turned that notary in for fraud. I contacted the Secretary of State. I demanded her notary records. She wrote back in an affidavit that she just can't produce them for that day. That's the kind of nonsense that's going on.
Well, I'm trying to see more than I'm trying to make the argument that people should just be able to, it's all screwed and everybody just stay in their house. I mean, you know, but I'm going, all right, so they got a home. They have a note that's out there that got traded. They are wanting to foreclose. They got, but my thing is where the real ethical problem comes in is that you have an entity that took advantage of a tax structure that was benefited by them not having the ability to foreclose. And now they want to be able to foreclose and not pay the taxes if they were in that position to foreclose. Now I'm wondering where the IRS is on this thing. There's going to be a payoff to the man, you know, for doing, okay, we'll let you do all this, but we're getting our cut, which will happen. I mean, you know, that's coming. I can feel that, you know. So I'm going, all right, so now let's go ahead and get to the actual, if you're challenging their specific ability to foreclose on your home, that's really where you're going. You're going, okay, do you have the ability? And you're finding out, no, and any effort on their part to try and put themselves in that position is fraud.
Absolutely.
And the courts, and when we come back, we'll go ahead and talk about that very part right there when she was in court this week, last week, and she's going, judge, man, we got to walk this through. Well, what did he have to say? Then we'll get with Tom Westbrook that, you know, has some income properties he's gone through. And what's this MERS thing? You know, who's MERS? Mortgage Electronic Recording Service or something. I mean, you know, and how the heck did they become an Indian? And where did they come from? And who are they? They were just a recording service. They're a computer somewhere. It's HAL 9000 created by the bank to do their bidding. You know, and it's fraud from the beginning. So I'm just, how does this unwind? I don't know, but I tell you who they, them, those, want to make sure who benefits. Not us, okay? Not us. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence, try to understand it some more.